May I please support counsel? I'm here on behalf of Robert Leek this morning. Essentially, there are two issues raised here. They both relate to sentencing, and I believe that the first issue in the brief is probably the most important one because I think that it would lead into the second. So that's where I'm going to start, and if you have any questions, please feel free. First issue in this case is whether or not the defendant, in a situation such as this one where he pled guilty during trial, basically, it was during the selection of alternate jurors, can accept responsibility for his offense. In this particular case, we were asking the court to allow Mr. Leek two levels of acceptance of responsibility. Obviously, we believed that one level would probably not come in because it happened at such a late juncture, but the two levels that he actually did accept responsibility for his conduct should be given. This was shown throughout because originally he wished to enter into plea negotiations with the government. Mr. Leek, as a matter of fact, gave an acceptable proffer to the government and was given a plea offer. Mr. Leek rejected the plea offer primarily because he just thought it was too much time. I believe the plea offer at that time was for 292 months, and Mr. Leek thought that that was too much time, so he rejected the plea agreement. Throughout the course of this, Mr. Leek never denied his guilt for any of this. As a matter of fact, he had testified at a motion in limine hearing on a Krillich issue and affirmatively stated that, yes, I'm good for this. Yes, I gave a truthful proffer, and I believe Ms. Morrissey actually asked him that. It was your proffer truthful? Mr. Leek said, yes, it was. Okay, so he's affirmatively established that, hey, I know I'm guilty. Now, he says, and I think that there was support in the record, that he was reluctant to come forward for some time. And the reason for this was that he had heard that he had credible threats against his family. Now, this in and of itself, I mean, if somebody just hears something, it's not a big deal. But in this particular case, one of his associates out in Arizona, a lady by the name of Sonia Miranda, was reportedly beaten up at the hands of persons who the defendant was actively doing business with. There was some testimony in the record that it wasn't really because of this, but the fact is that wouldn't have gotten out the hospital records and that sort of thing to people in jail. It certainly didn't get to my office, probably not to Ms. Morrissey's either until a late juncture. So I think that the threat could have been perceived to be credible by Mr. Leek, and certainly with the individuals that he was dealing with, I think that speaks for itself.
But didn't he call this person Donetta Porter and ask her to lie?
He called Donetta Porter and asked her to say, as I remember the testimony of Mr. Luco, that the drugs were not mine that you took, that they were actually a Mr. William Curley's drugs.
Well,
but there weren't any threats given.
Pardon? Well, isn't that witness tampering?
Well, that was what the court found at the motion to restore telephone privileges. That's correct.
And you didn't challenge that finding?
No, Your Honor, we really didn't challenge that finding. And the reason why was because, indeed, if he did not deny making the call. What he denied was the fact that he threatened her in any way.
And all he
was doing was asking her to say, well, the drugs were Mr. Curley's. Now, maybe they were, in fact, drugs that were taken over there by Mr. Curley. I don't know what the source of the drugs were. I think that Ms. Porter's, she did not testify.
But the bottom line is, in terms of the factual basis for the court's finding, you didn't challenge that.
That's correct.
And that's something, that obstruction of justice, is something the court can take into account on acceptance of responsibility.
That's correct.
And then even if the court had erred and we gave you, though, the three-level downward departure, wouldn't his offense level have still been 43, so he still would have been subject to life imprisonment?
Still would have been a 43. He still would have been subject to life imprisonment. And that's part of the point here, Your Honor, is that Mr. Leaf entered this plea after he knew that he had made these statements saying that I had this much dope. I mean, you know, literally, he knew at the time that he pled that he was chancing a life sentence. Okay? He really did know this. He went ahead and pled guilty anyway because he accepted responsibility for what he did. As far as the obstruction is concerned, he didn't make any threats to anybody. Now, there are cases where you can get both an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility and be hit with the obstruction of justice, too. I think that this is an extraordinary case in that regard because he never did say that I didn't do it. In essence, what he's saying is, this is too much time that they're offering me, and I'm hoping to get a better deal. Okay, that's in essence what he is saying throughout this. He did take the plea at the late juncture, but the reason why he took it, as I said, is because he had received these threats. I think there was some basis for him believing the threats could be carried out. And I think that under those circumstances, that does perhaps rise to such an extraordinary case where the defendant may, in fact, be entitled to both the adjustment for acceptance and the enhancement for the obstruction of justice. As you pointed out, he did come out, I believe, in the pre-sentence report as a level 46, okay, with all the enhancements. He came out as a 46. Even assuming that he lost a couple of levels, he would still be obviously above a 43, which is mandatory life for anybody. But the point is that if he did accept responsibility, then I think that kind of ties into the second point which is raised, which is that if he did accept responsibility, I think you have to reconsider whether or not you should depart downward on the rest of it.
And what's the theory for departing below the 43?
Well, the theory for departing below the 43 is that it falls outside of the heartland of cases, okay, because of the fact that this did go on for some time. I mean, there wasn't ever any.
Why wouldn't the argument for a downward departure be stronger that the higher the point from which you're departing?
I don't understand the part.
Well, if you're a 46, you have a, I would think you'd have a greater shot at getting a downward departure than if you were a 23, right?
I would believe so, yes.
So why, if you were able to knock him down from 46 to 43 or 43 to 40 or something with acceptance of responsibility, why would you think that would require reexamination of the downward departure?
Well, because if the court were to find, as Judge Herndon actually found in this case, which was that the two issues are actually intertwined, okay, he found that
I don't really understand it, because what you're really saying is if he got three-level discount for acceptance of responsibility, maybe the judge will give him three more levels. Well, but that's giving six for acceptance of responsibility. He's not allowed to do that.
Right.
So I don't see how you can piggyback a downward departure on a downward adjustment.
Well, in this particular, as I say, we're talking about extraordinary cases here, Your Honor, and that's what we would be requesting, is that such an extraordinary case be found for Mr. Leaf. If you have anything further, I'd be...
How old is Leaf?
Mr. Leaf is 46.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Abel.
Thank you.
Marcy?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The issue is whether the district court erred in declining to grant Mr. Leak acceptance of responsibility. The standard is whether he clearly erred, and the burden is the defendant to prove that the court clearly erred. In this case, the district court had numerous reasons, I think, for denying Mr. Leak acceptance of responsibility, not the least of which was the fact that Mr. Leak pled guilty after there were 12 jurors seated and prepared to hear evidence, and we were in the process of picking alternate jurors. It was at that time, the court pointed out, with the defendant knowing full well that the government's witnesses were present and prepared to testify, that Mr. Leek elected to change his plea. There are numerous cases, decisions by this court, where it is stated that a last-minute plea is not evidence of remorse, and that it is the district court's judge not to just accept a formalistic expression of remorse, but to look beyond that and look to a true moral acknowledgement that a defendant has broken the law or committed a wrong. And the district court simply did not find that with Mr. Leek. What the district court said in this case was, and I quote, and the quote is in the full quote is in the brief, but the district court found that what Mr. Leek wasn't accepting responsibility, but rather was accepting the likelihood that he would be found guilty. The court said Mr. Leek is simply accepting his circumstances and hoping to move on to the next stage and hoping that something may come along and help him out. The other thing that, of course, argued against acceptance of responsibility in this case was the district court's finding that Mr. Leek had obstructed justice. In fact, Mr. Leek had called one of the government witnesses against him, a Miss Jeanetta Porter, who was a woman, a widow, who lived alone in a rural community, and her and Mr. Leek had been childhood acquaintances, friends. They lived next door to one another, just down the street from one another. And he encouraged Miss Porter to testify that the drugs she received from Mr. Leek, in fact, came from an innocent person, an associate of Mr. Leek's, who had nothing to do with that particular transaction. And in the course of the conversation with Ms. Porter, Mr. Leek said, told her that he thought he could discredit the testimony of many of the witnesses against him, but he could not discredit her. And because of that, he was attempting to suborn perjury. There was further evidence, as pointed out in the PSR, that not only did Mr. Leek try to suborn perjury from Ms. Jeanetta Porter, but he also tried to suborn the perjury from a Tammy Quinn. He tried to get her to testify that the guns found in his house trailer were not in fact his, but were again this innocent person, an associate of Mr. Leek by the name of William Curley. And finally, the PSR provided information to the court that Mr. Leek had also contacted the landlord where he was living, the same trailer, and encouraged the landlord to lie and testify that that trailer, in fact, belonged to, again, this third person, William Curley, an associate of Mr. Leek. So there were several attempts. It wasn't just limited to Jeanetta Porter, even though that alone would have been sufficient. And there's nothing required. The guidelines do not require that Mr. Leek actually threaten to harm someone or succeed in his attempt. They merely require that he attempt, which is what he did on numerous occasions. Finally, another reason I think that the court had for denying acceptance was Mr. Leek's unsupported claim that he feared for the safety of his family. The district court, and I quote, Your Honor, said, after hearing testimony on whether or not Mr. Leek was really in fear, said, but there doesn't seem to be anything in the record or what I've heard today that suggests to me that a fear of retaliation by some persons or organization would have excused his, Mr. Leek's, plea prior to the time he entered it. And the government presented evidence by Sergeant Parker, the Illinois State Police agent on this case, that Mr. Leek's claims of fear for his family simply didn't wash. one of the things Sergeant Parker testified to was, well, he claimed some fear from the people he was being supplied by because he owed them money for various amounts of methamphetamine that had been seized by the police over a period of time. Well, Sergeant Parker pointed out that methamphetamine started being seized as early as March of 1999. The first person it was seized from was Mildred Christ, yet Mr. Leek continued to deal with the same suppliers. And it was in July 99 that more methamphetamine was seized. And Mr. Leek continued to deal with the same suppliers. As late as November 1999, that was when Mr. Hardy turned himself into the FBI, and a lot of methamphetamine, 6 pounds in fact, Mr. Leek was supposedly on the hook for, yet he still continued to deal with the same suppliers. And this went on through April of 2000. So Sergeant Parker's testimony was simply that, you know, if he really was in fear of these people, he wouldn't have continued to deal with them for over a year's period of time. In fact, the additional testimony on this was that during this entire time,
okay, Mr. well, do you want to say anything about the second issue, or?
Your Honor, I think the court has recognized that there's really no jurisdiction to review this. Judge Herndon clearly understood that he had a discretionary call, and he chose not to exercise his discretion. He said, I find no circumstance in this case that takes us out of the heartland, and find no reason to exercise my discretion to depart downward, and the motion is denied. So I think the judge understood his authority and declined to exercise it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Abel, how much time did you have? 1 minute. Do you have anything further?
Just very briefly, Judge. As far as Agent Parker's testimony in this case was concerned, I believe that Mr. Leek, in his statement to the court, stated that he had to pay off drug debts or else he was going to, you know, pay the price for it. Either his family or himself were going to pay the price for it. And that, therefore, he had to continue dealing with these people, and I think that's what he actually stated.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Abel, and you were appointed, and we thank you very much for your vigorous efforts on behalf.